Blog Talk Radio.
Hey everybody, it's your girl Cy Brown, and I just thank everybody for joining us today here on Life Remix Radio. As you know, today is the day that Dewan Colleon from Atlanta joined me and co-hosts the show with me. I'm up in New York. He's in the ATL. Today is a pretty good show. This was a very momentous week for us. President Barack Obama was inaugurated. Well, Barack Obama was inaugurated as our first black president. And now there's all this hoopla in the blogosphere. Is he really black? Is he not really black? Is he not African American because he didn't come from slaves? And I just saw a comment that has not been verified on Twitter that says, Rush Limbaugh really wants Barack Obama to fail, especially if he believes, if he starts to implement socialist policies. So I think rhetoric like that really dampens and hinders the spirit of what America really wants, and it's just really not a cool thing to say. But you know what? The beauty is that everybody's entitled to say what they want to say. And I believe to a certain degree, as long as it's done in a respectful way, not everybody is happy that Barack Obama is the president, and of course many people are. At this moment, his approval rating is hovering just over 70%, which is pretty darn high. Bush's approval rating was in the teens. So, I mean, that speaks to the country a lot about what's going on, about what's going on with this war, the wars in Afghanistan, the economy, and just a whole bunch of stuff that's going on that's really making people nervous about their jobs. Every morning when I wake up, I hear more people, more companies are going to be laying off people. So to really get into today's show about the spirit of what's going on, and you know here on Life Remix Radio, we always look at things from a spiritual perspective, from a universal law perspective, and what message is God trying to get to us, we have to look at how Barack Obama has handled himself. And I think, just based on my behind-the-scenes conversations with Dewan, Grace Under Fire is a great topic for today's show. I'm going to bring him in. Well, let's bring him in right now into the conversation. Dee, are you with me?
Oh, yeah. We ain't going nowhere.
Look, I said Dee, not Kirk Franklin. For those who are listening new and are not quite familiar, can you share with everyone who you are? I'm going to slow down my pace a little bit. I know I'm speaking very quickly, but there's so much to get out today, and I don't want to waste a moment in time. So just tell everybody who you are, what you're up to, and we'll get right into today's topic.
Okay. How my mic sound? My mic sound nice? I'm straight.
Check one.
I have a media background. I've been in entertainment for about 10 years on the media side in radio, television, new media. I've been involved on the political side doing some things with BET's Jeff Johnson and his foundation. Been involved in that on the political side, and just as a layperson on the ministry side, doing a lot of study and interaction with that in regards to ministry and study. So that's basically the three pillars of Dewan Colleon coming from those perspectives.
And also, everybody, check out his blog, ecclesiaatl.blogspot.com. It's ekkleseiatl.blogspot.com. So check out his blog. You will learn a lot. It's a hot blog. Let's get right into this because there's so much to talk about today. First, I want to talk about how do you feel about Barack Obama's being our president now?
I think it's gratification for me on one level because growing up, you know, as a African American from Birmingham, Alabama, and then, you know, living in various parts of the country. I remember when I was in the third and fourth grade in Texas, and I used to have, they set up their classes. You may be in the third grade, but within that grade level, like say for instance you're taking reading class, they will break down the reading class into different levels. You may have your slow level, which they would group, you know, kids in that class. They would have like your intermediate CD level, and then they would have like your normal pace classes, and then they would have your high achiever classes all within, you know, that reading class. And they would do that for math, you know, writing, history, et cetera, et cetera. And unfortunately, growing up, they would just automatically throw all the little black boys in the lowest class.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was coming along, you know, they put me in like the class above the slow class, and then, you know, after looking at my work, they couldn't really like keep me there because it was like too obvious, you know, I'm a little bit smarter than that. So they would move me up to like the next to the highest class. But you never going to be black and be in the highest class. It just wasn't going to happen. And I would, you know, I experienced a lot of situations where teachers were marking my work wrong deliberately on purpose, and I'd take it home and show my parents, and, you know, they would, you know, felt powerless to really deal with it because it was a systematic, you know, approach of racism in the school systems, you know, to try to keep black people back or children back by keeping them in the lower progress classes. So when I, you know, 20-something years, and you see, you know, an African-American being able to go to the best schools, graduate, and then achieve the highest office in the land, it's basically, you know, a small sense of vindication that despite the obstacles that people will throw at you, because it's all about position. You know, people know if they can keep you out of a position, then you won't have authority, you won't have dominion, you won't be able to do what God ordained us to do in the book of Genesis, which is have rule and dominion over the works of our hands. If you're never in a position to exercise that, you'll never be able to achieve. That's why, you know, starting with Frederick Douglass and going all the way up to Martin Luther King, the whole point of was to try to get access to positions so that, you know, African-American black people could, you know, be judged on the content of their character. So when you have someone like President Barack Obama being able to go through those doors and actually achieve position and dominion, then I look at it as, you know, a good thing. But at the same time, when you look at the state of affairs of the world that he inherits to have to deal with, he has quite a mess on his hands, not only domestically but internationally, that it's pretty much left up to him to deal with. And we will see, I guess, in the course of the conversation today, what he's about to face is no different than what Lincoln had to face, you know, dealing with the separation of the United States and the many things that could happen as far as that separation. So, you know, that's basically how I feel, you know, without going all off into the topic of the show about Barack Obama, President Obama, taking office.
Well, I feel the same way, and you know, I experienced that as well. Just being a relatively intelligent person, my parents always had to fight for me. I can name countless times that, you know, at 7 and 8 years old, I remember so clearly my grandmother going to school to fight to get me in honors classes and to fight to get books and to fight and get me more advanced books and to fight to give me more homework. So I remember that, and I don't think it's all over at this point. I just think that it'll make things a little bit easier. At least I'm hoping it makes things a little bit easier. Let's switch gears a little bit and talk about, how was Barack Obama, a person who is not really a person of faith per se as a career, able to galvanize the support of so many people when Reverend Jesse Jackson and Reverend Al Sharpton, who in theory were promoting the same message of unity, were not able to do what he was able to do? Is there something behind that?
Well, it's the topic of the show, Grace Under Fire. When you look back at Barack Obama's entire campaign, and he started very early. He had to deal with the scrutiny of the media, and now we live in a 24/7 media, not just, you know, mainstream outlets, but you got bloggers, anybody with a cell phone, a camera is paying attention to you and reporting it. He had to start under that scrutiny. And the Bible says in Colossians 4:6, let your speech be always with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how to you ought to answer every man. See, people always would kind of like mock and kind of criticize, oh, he's so eloquent, he's so articulate, he's clean. But biblically, he followed the biblical principles of how you are to address people and situations. In Proverbs 15:28, it says, the heart of a righteous man studieth to answer, but the mouth of a wicked poureth out evil things. When you juxtapose Barack Obama versus some of his civil rights contemporaries that we've had running for the office of president, whether it's Reverend Jesse Jackson or Reverend Al Sharpton, you will find, looking at their speech, you know, they have a lot of instances where they had inflammatory speech. They had
right.
the type that would incite, you know, it would be very polarizing, you know. So therefore, when they try to galvanize the people and run for a national office, you can't be the black president. You have to be the president of America for all people, races, creeds. You got to be able to have, as the Bible says, a seasoned with salt your speech to be able to communicate with people. So,
right.
You know, even though they're quote-unquote reverends, they really, you know, didn't quite know how to handle that. And it goes back to where it says in Romans 12:19-21, basically, it says that God says, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says mm-hmm. the Lord. If your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink, for by doing so you will heap burning coals on his head. Don't be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. So, you know, even in my own life, you know, I look at myself and I compare myself and I analyze myself based on that verse. I'm a very confrontational person. You know, I don't, you know, I'm like a pit bull. I don't care. Throw me in the ring. Let's get at it. Let's go for it.
Right.
But at the same time, you can't be like that. You have to know, you know, what battles to fight and how to, you know, how to talk to different people and how to season your speech, because, you know, there's bigger pictures. It's not always about self-defense. And I think African Americans, especially, you know, our older civil rights generation of African Americans, have been through periods of history where they were always under fire, always under attack, dogs, hoses, bricks, bombs, you know, threats, personal threats to their home and property. So it was very difficult for them to be able to contain that inflammatory speech. So regardless of whether it's Malcolm X or the Black Panthers or whomever, there's this inherent sense that we need to try to defend ourselves. But God says, don't avenge yourselves, according to Romans 12:19-21, but vengeance is his. You're supposed to be able to, as Martin Luther King stressed, do a movement of nonviolence, turn the other cheek, do good to those who despitefully try to use you and do evil, which is a very hard thing to do.
Yeah.
And you look at the campaign in which President Barack Obama now had to endure. He took a lot of criticism from a lot of different people. I heard foolish people talking about, well, Hillary Clinton is the only real man in this contest. You know, they would make type of accusations simply because he just wouldn't go turn into a gorilla and just act crazy and just sling mud and just, you know, get down dirty and do all the type of things that traditional politicians do. He wouldn't get pulled into that. And, you know, that was all just a trap, because they know once you see a black man act, you know, show passion or anger on TV, up, they knew he would lost a lot of his voting block, because, you know, we
right.
still don't know how to deal with that in this country. So he had to be able to walk out the tenets of Christianity indeed, without necessarily, you know, having to say it, because so many times people want to say, I'm Reverend so-and-so, and I'm Bishop this, and I'm Archbishop that, and I'm super
mm-hmm.
pastor whatever, and they try to say it, but their deeds don't match, you know, the words that they're saying. So what President Obama was able to do is walk out, let his light actually shine by how he handled himself. So therefore, it was grace under fire. But to take that to another level, we have to look at, now that he is actually president, what are these issues that he's going to have to deal with? And I know for yourself, you have wanted to talk about, you know, the Middle East, God, what that relates to. But first, before we, I go into that,
yeah,
you brought up.
Yeah, I don't go into it yet because I have one more, I have another piece before we even take the show in that direction.
Okay. I want to kind of back up to what you said from the beginning. I know some people might be like, I thought this was like supposed to be a Bible study. But what you got to understand, as a Christian, you're supposed to be kings and priests. And so sometimes I might put on my you know, priest outfit, but then other times you have to be able to put on your king, you know, grab the scepter and be a king. And a king is fully abreast of the affairs that are going on in the world so that he can know how to govern himself accordingly. So when you said, you know, Rush Limbaugh and a lot of the political pundits are, you know, articulating the message that Barack Obama is going to introduce socialism into our government, you know, it would behoove them to pay attention to what happened over the last 6 months. It was the Republican President George W. Bush that introduced socialist policies into our government by buying private and public companies and taking ownership in those companies, whether it's insurance companies, banks, and now even proposals to take over and bail out GM or auto companies. You know, Barack Obama is not doing something that hasn't already been started by Rush Limbaugh's party. So people need to understand that quote-unquote socialism is not starting with President Barack Obama. It was already put into motion long ago. Especially, it started back with Clinton with a lot of these deregulation policies, and then, you know, fast forward to, you know, what happened with 8 years with President Bush, deregulation, and then government coming in and buying this and taking over that and having a stake in companies. That is exactly what socialism is. Socialism is when the government is married to public and private business and seeks to influence and those industries. So, you know, people throw around terms, and a lot of times people don't understand what they're saying, and they're acting like it's something new, but no, it was already started with the previous administration.
We just talked briefly about, first of all, let me just give a quick shout out to people who are joining us in the chat room, and I see a lot of people listening through the phone. Hello, Christian Wives Club. Hello, High Road. And we have a couple of guests who are in the chat room and checking out what's going on. I'm toggling between the chat room and my notes. Typically, I'm very, very heavy in the chat room, but I'm perusing a lot of very important information right now, so I may not be too active in the chat room today. DeJuan, we just discussed briefly, you know, both of our opinions about the significance of Barack Obama now being a president, and I do believe we touched on why he was able to become president, whereas Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton were not. And you alluded to the fact that it had to do a little bit with the inflammatory remarks that they made on the campaign trail, and the fact that Barack Obama, quote, kind of, you know, never let him see his sweat. You know that quote they always say, never let him see his sweat. And I was one of those people that really wanted to see some level of passion or some level of something, some semblance of emotion from Barack Obama. And it got to the point where he was dubbed by Chris Matthews as No Drama Obama because he was just so cool. And I looking back, I'm so happy he was right and I was wrong, because I don't want somebody who's going to get inflamed under every little thing, show his passion, wear his heart on his sleeve, because now in so doing, by him maintaining that demeanor or that countenance, it would be extremely difficult to try to gauge him. People can look at me and know exactly what I'm thinking at any moment because I'm so animated, and they just know. But when you're dealing with a leader of the free world, such an important role as the president, I don't want people to be able to very easily pick him and see, you know, what's on his mind and be able to tag him. So I'm very, very happy that he did remain no drama Obama and did not bend to the whims and wills of people like Psy, who just said, can we see something? Can we see some emotion? Can we see some expression from you? I mean, he's absolutely brilliant, and he has a lot of challenges that are coming up. You know, we talk behind the scenes a lot during the week just before this show comes up, and I really want to get into Joe Biden's comment. It's itching me to hold it back. You know for a fact that I made an announcement a couple of weeks ago that we need to – or I wanted to do a weekly Bible study on what's going on in Gaza. Typically, I bring topics to this show in areas in which I'm trying to understand. I want to get what's going on. I want to understand. So what I do, the easiest way to help me learn is to bring it to the show and say, hey, let's collectively figure this out together. And you said to me at that point, you said, Saida, this is a little too much for us to all collectively do in a week between our jobs and between all the little intricacies and the details. I'm like, see, nope, we could get it even if we just break it down to 10 points and we discuss that and move from there. And you're like, sigh. And sure enough, the day before the show, I was like, D, this is too much information to digest. Let's put it off. But the beauty is that we're all on this quest to understanding what is going on over there, because I still don't know. You said that, well, we all heard Joe Biden and his loose lips. I mean, his wife the other day actually said on the Oprah Winfrey Show, and I watched it live and started blogging about it immediately, that I couldn't believe she said on national television right during our inauguration season that Joe Biden had the option of Secretary of State or Vice President. I mean, talk about open mouth and insert foot. But Joe said, and I believe it was in a radio interview, that Barack Obama's mettle would be tested once he got into office. And a lot of people just dismissed it as Joe Biden having very loose lips. That's just Joe Biden with loose lips. We know how he is. And immediately after that, the Obama campaign put the kibosh on Joe Biden. He couldn't say hello to the media. But now, as we are in this administration and starting to feel and see and experience how this administration is going to operate, we are learning that there is some truth to what Joe Biden actually said. Can you pick us up from there?
Okay. As we shift into the big topic, what we got to understand is I try to break this very complex, situation down as far as with the international foreign policy issues that immediately, I mean, within 3 to 6 months, you know, President Obama is going to have to deal with, hopefully not sooner than that, but the stage is already set. What you got to understand is life, and I always say this, life and business is like poker. If you've ever seen, James Bond, Casino Royale, it's just like you described Barack Obama's, demeanor as far as you can't tell, what he's thinking. You know, the best poker players in the world, I play poker, is you don't really play your cards, you play the man next to you. You gauge based, his reactions, his body language, what he has. And then you put that together with the fact that the greatest game that everybody plays all over the world is chess. And when you think of this situation in the Middle East and just the world, period, it's chess. It's a global chess game. You got to understand from the very beginning, we've always been at war. Even in the Bible, God told the children of Israel to go fight and conquer all the peoples of Canaan and every last one of the people with the last name Ikes, go destroy and fight them. And then you fast forward, whether it's Rome or Greece or England. There's always been wars after war because there's always ambition. There's always somebody trying to take over, expand their territory. And we relatively haven't had a major, major war in about 50 years, mainly because of technological advances that America has militarily over other people is the only reason why we have had, you know, some semblance of stability. Not that they're not, you know, jumping off everywhere, smaller wars, but that's the main issue. So we got to let's connect all the dots.
Yeah, please, because I want to stay on message and I want to understand this as well. So please.
Now think of this in the course of a chess game. So we're going to connect the dots. First of all, you got to understand, we went to Iraq because, for one, you know, we wanted to be over there strategically from a position of chess. We wanted to be in the Middle East, not only to have influence over oil, but also over, you know, other energy. I mean, you know, everybody has natural gas. Natural gas is a very, very important piece to this puzzle, and it's a very big piece that everybody in the world is trying to leverage and gain control. So by us strategically having a chess piece over there in Iraq, we not only can influence and control oil, you know, countries, European countries, Russian countries, everybody is trying to have a control over natural gas. Natural gas is something that you can't ship like oil. You have to be able to run pipelines. You got to be able to run pipelines from port to port. So it was very important to be over there. So that was a chess move we had to make to get over there. Despite what everybody says, oh, we shouldn't go over there, Saddam Hussein, 9/11, all that said, you got to understand that, you know, the art of war, Sun Tzu, he said all war is deception. So people are going to tell you whatever they feel like you need to hear to sleep at night. But ultimately, we have to position our pieces across the global chessboard in order to continue to be a dominant world power. So then you have that situation. Then fast forward, you know, immediately once we got over there, you know, Iran has always been threatening that they were going to wipe Israel off the face of the map. And as soon as we get nuclear weapons, we're going to do it. Well, ever since 1948, when Israel came back into their land, their homeland, they said, that'll never happen. We'll never get kicked out. We'll never get bombed out. Nobody's going to put us out. So we kept hearing all this talk, you know, toward the end of Bush's administration that we're going to attack Iran, we're going to attack Iran, we're going to attack Iran. And at first, we really was thinking about doing it. We wanted to do it. But at the same time, you know, being a great poker player and chess player that, you know, the leaders of Iran are, they didn't back down. They said, hey, you know, if you guys come over here and try to attack us and stop our ambition to build nuclear, do our enrich our uranium and possibly have nuclear powers to do whatever it is we want to do, maybe, you know, go attack Israel. We noticed that you got all your troops over here in Iraq, right south of us, and we may not have nuclear power, but we have the ability to disrupt all your operations in Iraq. We can blow up your little plans to build these pipelines across through Pakistan. So you got to understand all these names, all these dots that you're hearing, Pakistan, Afghanistan. These are areas where not only the United States are trying to build gas pipes, but Russia is also building gas pipes. Russia is the other major player on the other side of the chessboard. The two major players in the game is America and Russia. Even though people try to say, oh, you know, Russia, oh, they're nothing. They're nobody. They fell off the map. Fast forward. We were caught off guard when Russia moved their chess pieces and attacked Georgia. We didn't know what to do. Everybody was just in outrage. Why did they do that? How does that fit into the big picture? Well, for a while, Israel had been supplying Georgia with advanced weapons because they knew, hey, we're not going to let Iran get these nuclear power. And where, if you go look at your globe, where Georgia is positioned on the map, they're an excellent place for United States and Israel to be able to come in and do attacks from, you know, their bases to be able to come into Iran, because you just can't, like, march troops from Israel to Iran. You got to have staging places. You got to have bases. You got to have strategic places you can put your pieces to be able to move. So Georgia was a great spot for us to be able to do that. But then Russia was like, oh, we're not trying to hear that. We've been investing in Iran. They're like one of our major buyers of our weapons, and, you know, we're trying to do business with Iran, too. We're trying to build pipelines, because what people don't realize, Russia has one of the largest supplies of natural gas, and they have oil. If you combine the assets of natural gas and oil that Russia has, it's larger than Saudi Arabia. So they have the energy to be able to, you know, bully people around, because they have these natural resources that we all need. That's why you see all these commercials about getting off foreign dependence of energy, not just oil, but natural gas. All we need to have alternative fuels, because people are playing to win. So when Russia went over there and decided to invade Georgia, that pretty much stopped what Israel wanted to do, a way that we could have possibly done something with Iran, because that took away an opportunity. So then you fast forward from Georgia to the whole situation in Gaza. Everybody's like, oh, you know, why is Israel attacking Gaza and the Palestinians? Yeah. Well, they're not attacking Gaza. You know, Hamas and Hezbollah, these are, you know, terror organizations that's been in this area for a while, and all they've been doing is sending rockets over and attacking people in Israel. But people don't understand that Iran backs these groups. Iran funds them, and they give them weapons. So
I have a question. I have a question. Because you've just given us a lot of information to digest. So hold on one second. I want to make sure I'm understanding this. Iran wants nuclear power, and they want to wipe Israel out.
That's something they have said.
Okay.
Even the Ahmadinejad has said that he would do it. So it's no secret to anybody. That's something, you know, they would do. If they had the opportunity, they would do it. So therefore, our agreements that we've always had an agreement to protect Israel. But at the same time, Israel's like, yo, we got the weapons to protect ourselves, and we're not going to sit here and let somebody threaten us and do something to us. So we've always had this dichotomy in the Middle East to try to keep these two sides from going at each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's gotten to a point to when everybody's heard on the news when they said, you know, if things keep going where they were, you know, Iran would have the capability of producing nuclear weapons within 6 months. And they said that over the summer. Well, it's January 2009.
So, does that go back to the comments that Joe Biden made that his metal would be tested within 6 months?
Well, exactly, because you got to understand, you know, it just came out. If you go Google it and look at some recent articles, it's leaked out in the last couple of weeks that the Bush administration stalled, and they've tried everything they could to prevent Israel from attacking Iran last year, because we just didn't want to get involved in it, because it would just be too much to deal with at the end of his administration. And then we got too much at stake in Iraq. All that stuff could be really in jeopardy if Israel goes over there and attacks Iran, because, of course, Iran is going to attack them back. And then if we help them out, they're going to try to, you know, disrupt all our interests over in the Middle East. And at the same time, if you mess with Iran, you're pretty much messing with Russia and possibly China, because they have these. So when Joe Biden slips up and says, you know, President Obama is going to be tested immediately, when General Colin Powell says President Obama will be tested, and you've heard various other high-ranking officials leaked out certain, you know, the same type of rhetoric and language, everybody is fully aware of and apparent of what is at stake. So you have somebody, that's why there was this whole big push to have John McCain, because we want John McCain, because he's a military guy, and he can go over there, and we'll just bomb Iran, and we'll deal with him that way. But if you do that, there's a whole bunch of ramifications to doing that. You're basically hedging a bet. You're playing high-stakes poker that if you bomb Iran, that Russia doesn't have their chess pieces in place to be able to counterattack you and start World War III. So you don't really – you put all that at stake when you do that. So therefore –
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Continue. Keep going.
Therefore, that's why Obama has always been – we got to be diplomatic. We got to find other solutions. Maybe we can talk to, you know, the president of Iran. If you go look at, you know, in the last couple of weeks, the newspapers in Illinois, I think it was like the week of December 23rd, you know, Obama said, you know, I want to remake America's image over in the Muslim world. We got to, you know, we got, he said, quote unquote, we got to reboot the image. He under his policy or philosophy is, okay, yeah, we can easily go try and bomb them, but what are the ramifications are going to be? Do we really want to get in? So maybe we got to use some other leverage to try to get them to stop trying to enrich uranium and create this bomb, because if they create this bomb, then we can't hold back Israel any longer, because Israel is just going to, they're going to go out and defend themselves. They're going to do what they need to do to try to defend themselves. And if they go over there and start something, then, you know, you bring into the equation all the Muslim world. So then it takes us back to Gaza. Okay, why is Israel so adamant about trying to clear out Hamas and Hezbollah? Well, you got to understand, if you're going to attack Iran, you want to clear out enemies close to you so they can't counterattack you from there. So you got to go in there and clear out the Gaza area. So if you do attack Iran, you got to understand Iran, as everyone knows, has been supplying these groups with weapons. And, you know, it's news. It's not really published. But, you know, Israel has blockades up. They, you know, they're stopping the flow of, you know, ammunition to the Gaza Strip right now, so they can't reload. They can't get the supplies. They can't get this. Because if we decide to attack them in the next month or two or 6 months, we don't want to worry about having missiles coming from, you know, our borders right there. We don't want to have to deal with that. So you, if you look at this in the context of global chess, you got to clear that out. If you're going to try to do anything with Iran, you got to be able to at least, you know, put those fires out, or at least control, contain them enough to be, you to be able to do that. So then insert President Barack Obama. He is left with this situation that's not going nowhere. You know, Iran is steadily, they said 6 months ago we would have the capability to build nuclear weapons, and it's been 6 months, so it's, the you know, the clock is ticking, the sands is going through the hourglass. Israel is saying on the other side, we're not going to allow them to get it. We're not going to sit here and allow it to happen. We don't trust anybody. We're going to defend ourselves. And then you got to understand, I believe it's February 12th, Israel has a new election, and you got to look at the leaders that they are thinking about putting in office and the front runners. All these are very, very aggressive, military-minded people. So at the same time, you got to throw in President Barack Obama, who wants to be, that's why you got to notice the speech. At first, he was like, oh, I'm going to pull out all my troops out of the Middle East. Then, you know, people start asking me, he's like, oh, I don't know if I can do that. We got to see what's on the ground, because he understands I just can't pull everybody out if we have these situations going on.
Right.
And then I have to be strategic, because you got Russia on the other side of the table making moves to position themselves militarily, and not just militarily. They got all these natural resources of gas and oil in which they can go around and persuade other countries to get on their side or do business with them, because everybody needs the natural gas and the oil. So it's a very complicated situation. There's not really any good solutions that President Obama can really deal with. And what you hope doesn't happen is it just doesn't just start without him, you know, being able to do anything on the front end, because otherwise you'll have this full-blown situation about to happen. So when people think back to the inauguration speech, it was a very different speech. He was talking tough. He was sending signs and signals to people in the Middle East and abroad that, yeah, I may want to be diplomatic, but at the same time, if I have to, you know, we can handle this like some gentlemen, or we can get into some gangster stuff. So that's basically what he was saying, that he'll be willing to do if he has to do it, but it's not necessarily his first priority. So you got to notice the body language as he's meeting with John McCain, and he's meeting with Colin Powell and every other leader. He's trying to ascertain and get information the best way to handle this crisis, because it's not going to disappear. It's not going to go anywhere. It's going to be front and center sooner than we think. So it's something that has to be dealt with. So therefore, Not only does he have to deal with domestic issues with the economy, because you can't fight wars without money, at the same time, you know, do you pull all your chess pieces off the board to try to deal with a domestic issue? Meanwhile, your enemies or other people with ambitions to take over the world will be advancing their campaign. So it's a very, very dynamic and difficult situation to deal with.
There's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of activity in the chat room. So let me go back. I wanted to interject, but I didn't want to interrupt your flow. I'm going to go back a couple minutes, actually. Let's talk about from a point and a perspective of what we know. What we know as a fact, for those of you that may be taking notes, well, let me just say something very quickly in the chat room. True put in the chat room, did Barack meet with Colin Powell? On CNN, he said he had not met with the president. When did he say that, True? Because right now there's a lot of meetings that are taking place that are not privy, that the public are not privy to. So while you post that in the chat room, let me go back into what we know right now. What we know right now is that Iran is supplying countries with weapons. We know that. What we know is that Iran wants nuclear power. We know that. We know that Iran wants to wipe Israel out. We know that. Now, as far as Israel goes, you're saying, and from what I've read, is that Israel is attacking Palestine, Hezbollah, and Hamas because they need to do what?
Well, I'm just connecting dots. You don't have to agree with me if you don't want to. I just look at it from a global chess game. And if Israel has been, you know, talking like they want to attack Iran, which we know they do because they've said
right.
it over in the media for the last year, one of the major problems that people had with the war in Iraq, they say it wasn't executed properly and it wasn't executed a proper exit strategy, et cetera, et cetera. So if you're gonna go to war, you have to execute. You have to have a game plan. So if Israel's really serious about attacking Iran, you wouldn't go attack Iran and then have Iran's proxies right by your doorstep being able to counterattack you so easily. So you would want to make sure you deal with that first before you go head north. So that obviously to anybody observing would be like a subplot of why they feel they need to go ahead and deal with Hamas and those other entities that's right on their border because they are being supplied by Iran.
Okay, I'm going back because we're given so much information and I'm seeing a lot of stuff in the chat room where we're going, you know, back and forth a little bit, and I want to make sure we're not missing anything. And obviously, I would encourage everyone to go back, save this, listen to the archive for future reference because this is a subject that we're going to discuss all throughout 2009. We know for a fact that Russia is the largest supplier of natural gas and oil. We know that. Everybody was up in arms when Russia attacked Georgia. Now, the United States and Israel can come into Georgia to attack Iran. But why is Russia defending Iran? That's what I don't get. I don't get the correlation between those two.
Well, you got to understand it's chess, and I can't let America control everything that goes on in the Middle East. So if America is going to go in there and attack and take over Iraq, if I'm the opposing force, if I got ambitions to be a global power too, I'm going to go make deals with the opposition. I mean, it happens all the time throughout history. The major powers have always supplied, you know, both sides of wars and opposition. So, of course, Russia has a ton of stockpile of weapons that they need to do something about. So they're selling that stuff. And see, another thing you got to understand, you know, Rush Limbaugh and these people, they kind of sound idiotic because your major opposition is Russia, a socialist country. Basically what that means, all the private companies, the gas companies, the oil companies, whatever, when they make money, the government makes money. So what happens is these natural gas companies, these conglomerates they have, they're making money and they're kicking money back to the major, you know, to the Russian government, and now they have more money to go spend to do whatever they want to do.
Right.
It behooves America, and we already started it. We already started bailing out and taking over and doing stuff because we got to understand we may not be socialists and don't want to be socialists, but we've employed some of the tactics simply because we got to have the money and the resource to be able to counterbalance what's going on globally. And that's the thing people got to look at. People have to look at what is going on. We're in a global world. We're not in a flat world anymore. So,
Right. Thing
as a sidebar, as far as just as something as everybody's looking domestically with jobs, and everybody's like, oh, we hate NAFTA. We hate all these free trade agreements. We need to do something to get our jobs back. The reality, you're not going to get your jobs back. No different than we're going to go back to horses and carriages. We're not going to do that. Why? Because we've transformed the paradigm. We're in a global economy. You got to understand, if Cy Brown has a company and she says, I'm going to hire all American people and I'm going to produce a product, and then I got a company and I'm overseas and I'm going to hire the lowest, cheapest labor pool I can get to produce the same product, I'm going to have a lower economy as a scale. I'm going to be able to produce that product at a lower rate. And at the end of the day, since we live in a global economy, consumers are going to buy what they can get at the lowest price with similar quality. So, therefore, if you have an American company that has all these costs, and you know, inventory costs, all these payroll costs, you're not going to be able to go out of business, because even your American consumers are going to buy whatever's foreign that costs less, just like Dell. Dell has been losing a lot of money because the PC market has now been commoditized. Just like milk juice, people say, hey, I can get, as long as the specs are right, I'll buy the PC. It doesn't matter what the brand is. And the Chinese competitors can make the products at a lower rate. So, therefore, you'll never go back to a situation where we'll be able to keep our jobs, because we're in a global economy. Even if you got a mom-and-pop store in Birmingham, Alabama, you're still global, even if you don't think you are, because people in Birmingham can go online and buy that same product that you sell somewhere here in the United States or overseas, and they'll do it. So what we got to understand with the foreign policy, the things that we do that President Barack Obama has to do, we got to think global now. You can't live in a localized little village, because everything is on a large economy and scale. It's no longer what it used to be in the 70s and in the 80s. We're not going to be able to go back to that. People are going to have to retrain their thinking. They're going to have to retrain themselves, because systems and softwares and technology and robotics are replacing people, and we got to understand that. So this is the environment that we live in, That's why, you know, when I think about President Barack Obama becoming president, it's cool, but at the same time, he has a multiplicity of problems he has to deal with that are like, you know, the start of a whole new age, a whole new realm, and the decisions he makes are going to, you know, determine our outcome. No different than the president that he idolizes, President Lincoln. Imagine if Lincoln in the North didn't win the Civil War, if Lincoln doesn't make the right decisions. We wouldn't even be where we are today. We would be a totally different outcome in the world. You would have had two different countries, the South United States and the North United States. We wouldn't have had the strength and the world power to be able to deal with the coming future wars of World War I or the rise of Hitler. It would just been a totally different world. So we're, you know, history is repeating itself once again. We're at the precipice of another, you know, situation that's going to determine the future going forward.
Well, we have to look at the changing economies and the changing technologies and how all of these wars and arguments and disagreements affect and impact the decisions that are going to be made about our future. When you look at, when you talk about things that are going to become irrelevant in the global society in which we live, I feel so badly for the people in the Detroit metro area. They are not going to survive. These big three automakers, which is why I was totally against the bailout, you're putting a Band-Aid on a breaking dam. Those jobs are not coming back. The American perception to buy the perception for people to buy an American car, especially here in America, will not change in 3 months. Everybody is not going to start buying Chevys and GM trucks and all of these things in 3 months to make these companies profitable. And I said, you know, based on my emotion and what I understand, let them fall. I know there's going to be ramifications, and I know a lot of people, it's going to drastically increase job losses. But on the same note, there are some tough decisions really have to be made. But going back to bringing it all back to grace under fire, how President Obama is handling these situations, I believe George Bush did leave stall a lot of tough decisions and let that stuff flow into this administration. And I believe they're going to try to pin and place a lot of blame on Barack Obama when some of this stuff really, if you trace it back, you know, the etymology, when you're looking for the root of something, traces back to the Clinton years. We have to be really careful when we start making these statements with a broad stroke of a pen or whatever and say, oh, yes, this is how it is. No, you have to really look back, do your research, and really, really dig deep into these subjects. And that's why I said we're really going to be talking about this off and on, probably as long as I stay on the air. We're down to 6 minutes left in the show. I encourage everybody, everybody, everybody to please download this show. Start saving this information. High Road, I got that email you sent me about Gaza about a week and a half ago. I have saved it, and I'm still reviewing it. Thank you very much to everybody who was in the chat room. I mean, I had a beautiful full chat room. To Curly, your brother man, Indie Lady, how elegant. We had a few guests in the chat room, Dropping C, True View, Christian Wise, High Road. A lot of people in the chat room, because a lot of people want to understand. Ignorance is not bliss, people. We can't walk around ignorant and not knowing. We've got computers at libraries and laptops, and right now this is bigger than, well, I don't get down with politics because I don't be digging, I don't be feeling what they be saying. It doesn't matter. This is impacting your livelihood. This is touching you where you live. When you have Israel bombing, and a lot of people are saying they're bombing for no reason, you need to understand the implications of the allegiance of the Jewish people in the United States to their homeland. I'm black, and the plight of Africa and Africans is not that high on my priority list because there's no connection for me. There's a huge disconnect for me as it relates to the African diaspora and just the things that happen in Africa. I'm just not that connected. It's not something I'm bragging about. It's just something that is. But for Israelis and Jewish people, there is a very strong connection and allegiance to their country. And you better believe, and I hope I don't sound like I'm jumping on the soapbox with this megaphone, but you better believe without a shadow of doubt that the Jewish people in this country are very much involved with what's going on in Israel. And in 2 seconds flat, their allegiance, I believe, would be more to Israel than it is to the United States, even though the two countries are intrinsically intertwined. You have to understand, really, people, what's going on with this country, what's going on as it relates to Israel, Iran, Iraq, Russia, Georgia, Hezbollah, Hamas, and Palestine. And it sounds kind of corny that, oh, to say, well, you should have studied in history and understand a world map. You know what? I probably cut more history classes than I care to acknowledge. But the only thing I can do at this moment, at this exact point in time, is pick up from right here. I'm picking up from right here, right now, on this day, at this moment, at this time. I can't erase what I didn't study in high school. I can't go back and do a do-over. The only thing I can do at this point is try to learn and try to understand moving forward. So when I see these people on television saying certain things, we all have to start to be mindful and use our divine intelligence to pick up the codes. Because Dewan, you said it, and I just extended the show just so we don't get cut off, so everybody listening doesn't get cut off. But Dewan, you said it. There were a lot of codes in his speech on Tuesday. Can you speak a little bit to that?
Well, I don't have his speech in front of me.
I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but that's something that you and I both know, that when people say things, I say it myself. If I'm giving a speech, there's certain language that I'm using, speaking to directly to certain constituents.
Yeah, I just recall you would think, you know, in the context of just being elected, that his speech would have been, most people were expecting some type of inspiring speech. But when you think back to what he was saying, you know, how he was saying, you know, we're gonna be tough, we're gonna deal with you, we'll do whatever we have to do to protect our interests. You know, he said a lot of things toward those different regions of the world where we have, you know, impending situations going on. So he knew the world was watching, and everybody wants to see, is he going to be tough? Is he going to be a pushover? Is he just going to talk to us? Or is this somebody we can try, and we can try to, you know, take advantage of? So he had to, you know, put out his opening, you know, his opening cards to show people, you know, set the stage going forward. Now, is it going to discourage Israel or Iran from doing anything they're planning on doing? We don't know. We'll see. But like I said, you know, the clock is ticking, and neither side seems like they want to back down. And, you know, every option doesn't have roses and cherries at the end of it. Every decision that's made in this particular instance is going to have ramifications, and they're not going to be good ramifications. I think you have, with every decision he's going to make, there's going to be losses. You just got to decide which losses are the most expedient for you. So that's the situation that I believe that he's having to have to deal with.
It's tough. And my only, I don't know if regret is a good word, but my only emotion evoked from this is that when I hear people say that, when people start to make broad stroke comments about a Barack Obama administration, and we're not even 72 hours into this thing, you see what I'm saying? A lot of times, and I've learned this personally speaking with my own drama, there can be an instance in my life, and I'll sit at the, you know, say there's something catastrophic. Let me give you a better example. Let's talk what it is. I have stuff automatically come out of my account. I forgot something came out of my account, and a check came in, and I thought the check was going to be returned, and I went into a panic. So it's the middle of the night. There's nothing you can do. And you know what? Instead of getting into a panic, oh, my God, I don't want it to cause a tumbling effect and have all my checks returned, I said, you know what? I got to wake up in the morning, let the chips fall where they may, let's see what happens with the bank, and keep it moving. Lo and behold, once the bank did its updating, my overdraft protection kicked in, and the crisis was averted. And I know that's probably, you know, a sidebar to this, but I think that unfortunately is what's going to have to happen in a lot of situations that President Barack Obama is going to have to deal with. He can, on the campaign trail, say, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this. But now that he's in there and he's getting a full assessment and he's getting a full peripheral view of what's going on, he's going to have to say, wait a minute. We need to see how this is going to play out before we start making these quick knee-jerk reactions and decisions. He can say, well, this pissed me off, let's do this, and all of a sudden that was the wrong thing to do. So I think a lot of it, we're going to have to sit and fall back a little bit. We're going to have to fall back and say, you know what, let me see where this thing is going. Let me see where this train is going before we start making these rash decisions and making these just things that can cause even bigger detrimental effects on our country. Because right now, we don't have any wiggle room. We are choked, I believe, up to our neck right now with both hands wrapped around our neck. 8 years ago, there was a surplus. Now, not only is the surplus gone, but we're in such a deficit. Our children are illiterate, not well, cannot perform, cannot compete, yet we have the best colleges. America's the unemployment rate is rising, so we are stifled and we're being choked. The life is being choked out of us right now. And this man's got some tough decisions to make. And I'm happy he has the nerve to get in front of the American people and tell us what we need to hear versus what we want to hear. Because it's going to be tough, and I think it's going to get worse before it gets better.
I agree, and I think one of the things that he is aware of, and people have to be cognizant of, that we have to be able to move the paradigm from where we were economically and domestically. It's just like how America was before energy or the advent of lights and electricity. We had a totally different economy, a totally different job structure, totally different lifestyle before electricity. Once electricity came on the scene, it brought about a whole new economy, different industries, et cetera, et cetera. So now we're in a global situation. We got robotics, we got technology, we got software. All these things are replacing people. It is a irreversible trend. Unless for some reason we get rid of electricity and we get rid of our technology, people are going to have to embrace the fact that, you know, with this new president and presidents coming forward, you know, we're going to have to adjust our whole way of thinking and our economy and our lifestyles, because the way we were doing it doesn't fit the paradigm of a global economy. Unless you want to be Switzerland or you want to be, like I've seen, you know, pictures on Yahoo where they discovered a new tribe in South America that nobody has ever seen. People, they've never seen people who still had spears in their hands. They had their faces painted, and they were looking up at the planes that was taking pictures of them. I guess they thought this was the end of the world because they had been cut off from all the, you know, advances in society. They still are doing the same thing they were doing for probably 1,000 years. They're somewhere in the jungle doing that. That's our alternative. Either we decide to just stay somewhere isolated and try to do the things we've always done, or we have to make those hard decisions, those hard choices to do other things. And that's what President Obama was saying in his speech. He can't, like, bring back plants. He can't bring back manufacturing and all these other industries where you could just go punch a clock and go put together something and put a widget onto a widget, and you have a job and you stay there 30 years and you retire and you get a pension in the 401k. That's not coming back. Nobody can bring it back. McCain couldn't bring it back. Nobody, because we've moved past that. So people have to really look at themselves from an educational standpoint and a personal standpoint and see how they're going to fit and adjust and move with the current that is with this new global situation that we have.
Yeah, because you know what? And I think that's why a lot of Americans, they're looking for – he was the only one that said those jobs are not coming back. And I will never forget when he made that comment. Oh, what do you mean they're not – those jobs are not coming back. We have transitioned into a new time, a new place, and a new era. And, I mean, I feel totally blessed to live in New York City. That's – well – I live right outside of New York City, but to grow up in New York City and see the diversity of careers, the diversity of career opportunities. I could be a waitress and an actress at the same time. I could be a pop locker and a cake maker at the, you know, but for areas of the country, these you know what they call them, like one horse town or one farm or one mill town or something like that, that's the only employer there. I know when I visit Louisiana, my husband has family dispersed through Louisiana. We went last year on vacation, and there's a paper mill, and that's the employer. Everybody, when you get out of high school, you go to work for the paper mill. And I was so shocked. I couldn't even say a word because I knew anything out of my mouth would have made me sound like an elitist New Yorker. So I just stood there stunned, like, what? Like, I just couldn't believe that that's where everybody goes to work. They go to work at this paper mill. And God forbid that paper mill shut down. What happens to that entire town? I don't know. And that's what we're faced with this car crisis. Let me just read some things in the chat room. Hold on 1 second because I'm getting a text message too. Okay, sorry about that, everybody, because the show is running a little bit late today. Let me just read some stuff in the chat room. Dee, thank you so much for sticking around. I know you probably have to go, but I didn't want us to get cut off. We're talking about, High Road says, we better start taking responsibility for our own economic well-being, cooperative economics for all the people who are into Kwanzaa. Yeah. Oh, Curvy Queen just put in the chat room. She's been listening on the phone. Yeah, I saw you. Here's another comment that was made in the chat room, and it says, whoops, I just closed the screen. Sorry. And it's still taboo for, quote, leaders of nations, end quote, to depend on the Most High One. You know something? For those that don't believe in God or atheists or you don't believe in universal principles and stuff, I don't know what to tell you, because right now we're in a quagmire. We have gotten ourselves into a pickle, and I believe only God can get us out of this. And I believe Barack Obama is anointed enough and anointed as a man to do this job, because I can't think of any politician that would have been able to do this job. I just want to wind back the tape very quickly, and we're going to wind down the show. To what I talked about at the top of the show when I said, when I made the comment that Barack Obama was able to do something that Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson were not. I believe Barack Obama is the man appointed by God at this moment to get the world out of this mess. For anybody that looked on the on inauguration night, the sea of faces and the global support that he got was unsurpassed by any other world leader. Now, when you look at Reverend Jackson and Reverend Sharpton, reverends, two people that proclaim the gospel of Jesus Christ, they couldn't even get complete and full support from the black community, needless to say, anybody in Iowa. So I think we have to look, even as we're looking at the global economics, and as Dewan so aptly put it, this global chessboard, and we have to move pieces, it takes someone like Barack Obama to sit back and say, wait a minute. We can't use religion as a separator, and I think that's what happened to those two presidents or people running for president happened to their campaign. They were seen as too divisive. And last time I checked, religion and spirituality is supposed to be a uniter and not a divider. And for some reason, their religious views polarize what is typically considered a very Christian country. So that's something that, as a side note to what I do on a daily basis, I'm really looking into to explore why he was able to do what they were not able to do, yet they supposedly epitomized what a Christian leader looked like. So, Dee, do you have your final thoughts so we can start to wind this broadcast down?
I would just like to say, you know, whether Barack Obama is able to do whatever it is we hope he does, we got to understand that regardless of who is president, God appoints those leaders. He raises leaders. He sits down leaders. He says that he controls the hearts of kings. So you have to, you know, you have to support whoever your leader is. You know, one thing that disturbed me, a lot of people thought it was funny that, you know, President Bush got shoes thrown at him. But at the same time, I mean, he represents the United States, your country. That's you. So when somebody throws shoes at him, they throwing shoes at you. You have to have the same level of passion and enthusiasm for whomever your leader is, period, because ultimately God is sovereign and in control, and he will use that particular leader, whether it's McCain or Sarah Palin or Jeb Bush or President Obama. He will use them to do his bidding on the earth for that particular moment in time and particular season. So what we have to do, looking at this situation, as you stated, you know, the situation that Obama has inherited, we got to remember that he inherited. If you can't continue to listen mm-hmm. to a lot of these, you know, political pundits, they're going to try mm-hmm. to spin it like he created this stuff and it's his policies that made this happen and all this. And you know, try to get you diverted from, you know, once we went over to Iraq and did what we did over there, you really can't really turn the hands of that clock back. You're in there. You're there. It's just like, you know, you mess around and you have a baby. You got one. Now you got to go forward and figure out how you're going to raise the baby and you know, you know, do everything you need to do for it. So he's inherited this situation. So now people have to come together and not be divisive about it and be partisan about it. But what they're going to have to do is collectively reach across the table and put our minds together to come up with a solution that doesn't start us into World War III. So
mm-hmm.
that's what people need to be focused on instead of, you know, talking all this foolishness on the television and on our airwaves, radio shows.
Amen, my brother. Well, that winds down today's broadcast. Thank you very much, everyone who tuned in. You have just heard some knowledge, my brother, from Dewan Kolion, who joins us every week and hosts our weekly Ecclesia Bible study. And I always, you know, blog about our weekly life study because the things and topics that Dewan brings to us, so graciously brings to us every single week, not only are they biblically based, but based on things that we can apply in our life. And I'm asking if everybody can keep Dewan and his family lifted in prayer, not for any specific reason, but just keep his family lifted in prayer so we can send our energy and our light to him to keep him strengthened. Because, D, you truly are a modern-day teacher of God's word, and you have an innate ability to bring it home and make it resonate so we can all apply it in our lives. So thank you very, very much. I love you so much for coming to us, for the time that you take out of your day to come every single week and bring a good message and a good word. So thank you. And everybody, keep Dewan and his family lifted in prayer. He does a great job. And yes, everybody saying, hey, yes, thanks to Dewan in the chat room. So thank you very much, D. I appreciate it.
I love you, man.
You're so sweet. We could laugh. We could all laugh. Since when is a preacher the definition of a politician? Oh, I'm not getting into that. We're going to talk about that. Anyway, everybody, stay on top of your game about this whole. Let me just give you the key things to look for before I do our closing words. Mama Smokey put in the chat room she's clapping for you. She's got these big hugging arms, and she's clapping for you. So she said, seriously, you are the bomb. And then How Elegant put in the chat room she's laughing at you when you said, I love you, man. but for anybody that wants to explore a little bit more self-study, study Iran, how they're supplying countries with weapons, study Israel and how they came into their land in 1948, study if Israel is bombing for no reason, study what's going on with Palestine and the Palestinian conflict with Hezbollah and Hamas, study Russia attacking Georgia, study U.S. and Israel, why they want Georgia, and also study how the implications of Russia being the largest supplier of natural gas and oil, that they're even larger than Saudi Arabia. So those are things, I guess, as a final note to look at so we can come back and visit this, because this is something that I am not letting go, everybody. Thank you to everybody in the chat room. We had a very, very full chat room. Really quickly, Curvy Queen says, Sai, tell Dewan I'm still waiting for him to accept my friend request on a particular name site. So I don't know what that one is, but I guess you know what that means.
Yeah, that's club981lounge.com. I'm about to go on right now. That's a spot everybody can come. You know, we talk about relationships, music, politics, all that, club981lounge.com. I'm about to go accept this friendship right now.
That's funny. Well, yeah, that's what she put. She said, tell Dewan I'm still waiting for him to accept my friend request on a particular name site. So is it club981.com or club981lounge.com?
Lounge.com.
Okay, so everybody, club981lounge.com. And then don't forget Ecclesia, ekklesiaatl.blogspot.com. Everybody, I love you all for listening. And please remember that we shall pass this world but once. Any good, therefore, that we can do or any kindness that we can show to any human being, let us do it now. Let us not defer or neglect it, for we shall not pass this way again. I love you too, Curvy Queen, and I'll see everybody tomorrow. I've got some good music coming up for us. Let me tell you, I'm going to give you a little hint as to some of the stuff I'm playing. I found some Father MC. I found Cinderfella by Dana Dane, and I also found Pause by Run DMC. So we're going to have a good time tomorrow jamming on a Friday. Welcome to the weekend. Get your swerve on at your desk. I love you all, and I'll see you tomorrow at 12 noon. Peace, everybody. I'll talk to you later.